This is the AFL Show, part of the Mojo Sports Network.
Hello and welcome to the AFL Show on the Mojo Sports Network. I'm your host, Ben McQueen. I'm filling in for Maggie this week, who's got some footy training. I'm joined again by Yuri and Alan. How are you guys going?
Great, Ben, and great to be back on the show as well for another week. And of course, gather round four right away. So yeah, definitely a lot of implications that we're sort of keeping our eyes on too, but it's going to be another really fascinating round.
Yeah, I'm good, Ben. Good to have you on taking the reins this week. Yeah, looking forward to this gather round too.
Yeah, keen to chat some footy with you guys. So if we go through the round just gone, Collingwood got a good win at the Gabba, finally bouncing back from 0-3. That does, of course, mean the Lions go to 0-3. So both grand finalists have now started without a win in their first three. So it'll be interesting to see if they can bounce back. I find it interesting how I think the general evening out of the competition has meant that we have seen two teams in Sydney and GWS in recent years bounce back from their rough starts. So interesting to see if that can happen again this year. There's been some questions over whether North Melbourne deserved their Good Friday game. They, again, were pretty uncompetitive against Carlton, and Carlton were able to push on with their strong early season form. They've got a really juicy matchup against Frio coming up now, so it'll be interesting to see if they can build on their 3-0 start to the season. Going on to a pretty rough game over in the West with Frio getting the win over Adelaide, who were able to only to score 34 points. Interesting to see where Matty Nix goes from there, and we'll be discussing that as Yuri was able to attend that one. St Kilda fell to a comeback from the Bombers in a close one at Marvel. Got off to a great start, but then just capitulated after that and weren't able to get a grip of the game. Port Adelaide weren't able to stand up to their first real test of the season against a really strong Melbourne side. They're back in the top three, and it'll be interesting to see where they go from there. West Coast have to go back to 2022 for the last time they scored over 100 points in a game. They got smashed by the Dogs at Marvel. Richmond were able to get their first win of the season under Adam Uze as the Swans, who looked really good, fell to them at the G. And then we've got Geelong, who were just too strong for the Hawks in Tommy Hawkins' 350th game. So if we get started by looking at Collingwood's win over Brisbane at the Gabba, Yuri, what do you think is the catalyst for the Pies' win here?
I think the number one barometer all night, Ben, was the tackling. 85 tackles all up for the team. Josh Dacos led the way with 8 tackles, and only one player was Will Hosking-Elly, who didn't lay a tackle. And it just epitomised what Collingwood wanted to bring and what their DNA's been for the last two seasons under Craig McRae. And they pretty much just out-bullied Brisbane at will. You could see within passages of play that there were 2-3 Collingwood players swamping upon a Brisbane Lion player and putting them under immense pressure. And I think the last quarter really just embodied that because the Lions were making a charge. Hugh McCluggage kicks out running goal, narrows the margin to 9 points. And then Brisbane get within 9 once more, I think 3 or 4 minutes later. And Jamie Elliott lays a big bruising tackle, which you can almost put in equivalent to a rugby union tackle. That's just how ferocious it was. And he goes back and wins himself for holding the ball free and goes back and truly converts what was a really, basically the most probably bat-breaking goal, I think, in the context of the game. And it just really summarised the Magpies' want and desire right throughout too. And there was another passage even before that too where I think Jack Crisp was the recipient of a goal as well. And he also applied really good pressure on Lockie Neal, which forced him into a pretty scrappy kick, and the ball fell in his direction and converted truly of all the poise that we know Jack Crisp has had over his very long and illustrious career. And I think when you look early on with Collingwood and what they were able to set up was the Bobby Hill show early on, 3 first quarter goals, and they were getting Brisbane out the back. That first goal, which the Magpies got within a couple of minutes of the game, just really sort of allowed them to dictate terms. And Brisbane were pretty much their own worst enemy in a way on the night as well, Ben. They just were trying to find those avenues through the corridor, which they're so well accustomed to doing, but they just kept clanger kicking it straight into a Collingwood player. And they just kept breaking down in their half forward line. And when they did enter inside their forward 50, they didn't really help their cause by kicking basically to a pack and not having those leading targets of Joe Danaher or Eric Hipwood, who were both reasonably quiet all night. And also Charlie Cameron, and those three have only combined for 12 goals to start this season, which by their lofty high standards is very unusual of them too. So look for them to have a big bounce back against North Melbourne. But yeah, just I think when you look at Brisbane's midfield, when you take away Lockie Neal, and I think it was pretty much well sort of embodied in that first game against Fremantle, that Josh Dunkley's 26 touches wasn't as damaging as he usually produces with either by hand or foot. And the same thing again against Collingwood. There just wasn't that real penetration there. Yes, we saw Hugh McCluggage break the lines at various times. And of course, just mentioned there, that running goal he kicked early in the fourth quarter to really give the Lions a sniff. But apart from that, it's sort of, what else are they doing wrong at this stage? The Lions, that's not garnering them that success that we all know and have been grown accustomed to since 2019. So there's definitely a lot of questions there for the Lions to address. And one other thing I think they're really missing too is Kadeem Coleman's absence as well, because it's put a lot of pressure on Dane Zorko, who's had to go to half back. And of course, we saw last season Zorko do that to an absolute T. But when he plays a lot of pressure on him or Darcy Wilmot, and teams can just put a defensive forward on him, and it really sort of negates a lot of Brisbane's drive off half back.
Yeah, definitely. So there's been a lot made of course, the Las Vegas story, where there's been rumours that Charlie Cameron's WhatsApp essentially was sending message back home, and there's been a lot of other faithful Lions players, and there's been rumours, of course, and speculation from the footy media that has crept into the performances of the playing group. The Lions, of course, denied this quite strongly. But Yuri, do you think that there's anything in that? And if not, what has been the cause of this huge drop-off from the Lions?
I don't think that has any cause. I don't believe so, Ben. And I think one that the Brisbane Lions football manager, Danny Daly, spoke to the media as well for about 7 or 8 minutes and refutely denied those claims as well, what happened with the Brisbane Lions US trip at the end of last season. But I think it just goes more down to fundamentals and execution, and also lapses in concentration. We've seen already in the two games against Fremantle and Carlton, where they got out to a 46-point lead against the Blues and a 25-point lead against the Dockers in the first quarter. And then it's just been a structure. And I think there's also been in the contest as well, where they spread quickly from the stoppage, but they're sort of caught napping defensively, because so much they're expecting the ball to go their way. But then ultimately, when you look at a particular passage of play, they're pretty much on the back foot. They're pretty much expecting to get the ball themselves or be a recipient. And that's where they're getting burnt the other way, in terms of not having that two-way running and not being held accountable defensively. So they've got to really get back to those areas, because when you face North Melbourne, who've been competitive right in the first three games this season, you give the Kangaroos a sniff, then they'll be absolutely right up to the contest, you could say, for three quarters, depending on what the Lions are able to rectify with those early season woes.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I think this is one of those things that in footy, when things go wrong, there always has to be an answer as to why it's happening. I think there would have been successful playing groups in the past, and I think, unfortunately, this sort of thing is quite common, and there's been successful groups that have just played and sort of conquered it and got beyond it, whereas when things are going wrong, there has to be an answer. And I think you even look back to the participants in the grand final, 21 Dogs in Melbourne really dropped off compared to their high standards, 22 Sydney dropped right off, and even Geelong by their, you know, just immaculate standards, they've said they dropped off. And then, of course, this year, Collingwood, the team that beat them, have dropped off as well. So if we go back to you, Yuri, you, I believe, had the privilege to be in the coach's box for the Fremantle game. So I've never been inside a box. What's it like, and how did you find that experience?
Oh, the media box is a pretty surreal feeling, Ben. You almost feel as though you're fish in water a little bit as well, because you're surrounded by prominent AFL journalists who've been doing their craft for a long period of time, and you still just have to absorb as much as you can as well, but also not feel, not starstruck in the way too, but just feel out of place. And that's the most important thing. Once you go to a few games and get to meet people, then you eventually feel a little bit more comfortable as it goes on. And I still remember my first time as well, only a couple of weeks ago, going to the media box. And I've always feel nervous anyway. I'm always a nervous type of person attending any new event, but this was to another level, and one that sort of had to just take a little bit of time to get adjusted and sort of acclimatized to new settings. But it was absolutely a worthwhile experience. And those experiences you absolutely cherish, because it just basically builds to your profile. But yeah, just going on Friday night's game too with Fremantle Adelaide, Ben, it was 51,037 that rocked up to Optus Stadium. But it was by far one of the worst live games I've been to since 2011. Fremantle and the Western Bulldogs, that Anzac Eve clash. Just the skill errors right from the outset were just was deplorable. They couldn't hit their 450 targets, both teams. Adelaide had a few passages here and there. That first goal, which they had a really good chain of play as well, with Isaac Rankine and Taylor Walker leading to a Ben Keys goal in the first couple of minutes of the game. And you thought, oh, that's going to be a real tonic for the Crows, able to push the ball with speed, which we've grown accustomed to as well with Adelaide. But just unfortunately, they fell trapped to just really poor entries. But there was also another really good entry they had early in the second quarter, where Rankin lowered his eyes and hit up Chris Burgess just outside 50. And of course, the former Gold Coast Sun and the new Crows recruit went back and flushed a pretty good goal from outside the 50-metre arc. And just thought, yeah, the Crows are probably starting to just wrestle a little bit of ascendancy here or there. But Fremantle just, yeah, were able to will themselves back in the contest. Michael Walters was by far the most prominent dangerous forward on the night, Ben. 2 goals, 4, and there were so many gettable opportunities which he squandered by his usual standards, but it sort of didn't matter too much anyway, because Fremantle controlled the last 15 minutes of that first half in terms of the forward half dominance. I think by half time, the inside 50 entries were about 28 to 17 or something, and it sort of really sort of signified that Fremantle should have been a lot more, maybe ahead by 4 or 5 goals at stage. But just like Adelaide, they were culprits to really poor disposal efficiency. Then we saw by the third quarter, Adelaide just couldn't shrug off their poor kicking disposal. And Wayne Miller, who we'll touch on very shortly, had an absolute howler of a kick from a kick-in, which led to a Jai Amos goal. And it's just one of those ones that you couldn't give in a very low-scoring game. At that point where Fremantle were only leading by 3 points midway through our third quarter. And yeah, just really was almost another backbreaker in the way for the Crows. And then sadly, Miller, I think it was 1:50 left in our third quarter, went backwards with the flight of the ball, trying to spoil a marking contest, and sadly hurt his right knee once more too. And it's just been a real raft of injuries for Wayne Miller. I think 2020 he suffered a season-ending ACL injury, and just unfortunately, he just hasn't been able to establish this continuity with his body where he's able to play 20 to 22 games in a season, right? And it's just, yeah, it's just another real heartbreaking story for not only for him, but also for the Crows for the rest of this season too, because he provides so much of their run off half back with his really efficient ball use too. So, and then come the last quarter as well, that was pretty much where Adelaide ran out of gas and only registered two behinds that final quarter, and Fremantle made them pay. Michael Frederick's poise as well, leading to a Bailey Banfield goal, was just, yeah, the one of many to really sort of put the nail in the coffin for the Adelaide Crows. And Nixie was left pretty despondent after the game as well, when he only kicked 4 goals from 44 inside 50 entries. And he really harped upon as well with the midfield to forward entrance as well, with that synergy connection, which just hasn't been there right through the first three rounds. And JL, Justin Longmuir, basically wanted to make the game a real arm wrestle. And they were able to do that, right, where the Crows, of course, have known since the start of last season to be a really high-scoring team. Last season, what, they averaged 95 points a game. This season, through the first three games, they're only averaging 55. So Fremantle achieved their mission. Yes, there's a lot of areas to rectify, but for the Crows, yeah, definitely a lot of soul-searching coming out of that game, Ben.
Yeah, definitely. And there's been talk from Adelaide that they don't define the Melbourne clash as something that's going to set the tone for their season, but they do have a really difficult start. So, Yuri, where do the Crows go? Do you think Nixie's going to stick around for the long haul? What constitutes a success of a season from here? Because I think finals is a long shot from this stage.
Okay, so to touch upon that, Ben, too. So Matthew Nix, before the start of the season, signed I think it was a 2-year contract extension until the end of 2026. So his job's safe, that's fine. But I think for the Crows as well, they're missing Riley Filthorpe, who's out, I think, for the first couple of months, should I say, as well, with a long-term injury. So that really hurts their forward structure, and having to leave so much onto Taylor Walker and also Darcy Fogarty up forward there too, and Chris Burgess. If Burgess is able to contribute his couple of goals here or there, that's going to really help as well. And Isaac Rankine and Josh Richelli there has been a real damaging small forwards at ground level. If they're able to get those five clicking, especially tomorrow night, right? And the only other source of inspiration I think you can look at for the Crows as well, which really sort of kick-started their season, apart from that round three win last season against Port Adelaide, that round five win against Carlton, when they kicked 7 goals in the opening quarter. And that's where I think people started to really sort of prick their ears and say, oh, this is a pretty legitimate team. They're starting to really make their mark after 3 seasons of rebuilding the side. And so that's where I can see as a real sort of embodiment as well for Adelaide to really look upon, to really sort of get their season up and running. And even I sort of go a long way back too with this as well, Ben. I think the Crows started 0-3, if I'm not mistaken, in 2001, and finished 8th that year as well under Gary Eyre. So that's just another example that the Crows can take away too and sort of really use that as fuel to the fire and somehow not build upon, but try and really rejuvenate this early stuttering start to the season.
I think in the modern competitive era, if there is going to be a time when a team can start poorly and make the finals, it is this time of year. So hopefully for the Crows fans, they get a good performance at home and gather around against a really good team in Melbourne. So for the next game, Alan, you wanted to touch on the Western Bulldogs. There's been talk around the West Coast Eagles and already whether they need the priority pick, probably a bit premature with that discussion. But what did you see in this one?
Yeah, I mean, this game sort of turned out sort of how you expect, but for West Coast, it's the lack of competitiveness for long periods of the game, which is really their issue. I mean, isn't the weekend the first quarter they sort of held their own quite well, but then it's 11 goal in a row for Western Bulldogs and just controlled the game. They had 146 uncontested, 146 marks through the entire game. They're just able to keep the ball. West Coast couldn't press up. They're just able to chip through, control the ball all the way to the forward line. I mean, Norton was playing up the field. I mean, they had Bontempelli playing as goal square because of his injury from the previous week. But Norton was able to just roam up the hit the logos on the wings, had 20 touches, had 13 score involvements, and they're just unable to touch him throughout. And they just have no, they have the ability to say, yes, I've got a couple of players who can put him in the midfield, have a bit of a stop gap, get control, get some clearances going forward their direction, get a couple of goals just to stem the flow. They don't have that ability at the moment. Now, they are still a year a young side, with a lot of young players like Harley Reid, Ruben Gimby, etc., which have a lot of talent and are going to be a very good players in the future, and they just need to get as many games into it as possible. Now, in terms of priority picks, etc., I'm not on that for them to get there, but they're going to be down the bottom of the ladder for a good couple more seasons until they get a full connected list together. But they are still have the issue is they're 24, the 20 sort of age bracket where they don't have many players in that sort of age bracket, so they need a couple of years through them with kids. Get them to that 24 age, 100 games experience, and they're going to bounce up very quickly when they get to that stage. But that's still a few years away. But for the Western Bulldogs, they're just starting to almost click as a unit now. A couple of games in a row, they're getting a bit of clearance dominance through the midfield because they've got such a good depth in that midfield. But also, the half back line now starting to really click as well. They're getting a bit of ball movement. The Bally Williams game was fantastic at the weekend. So they actually start to open up teams. So they're starting to really improve and look towards being sort of that top 18 that you expect them to be.
I think Norton's probably up there for most underrated player in the competition. He's just had an absolutely exceptional start to the year, six against Gold Coast last week, and then I think 13 scoring dolphins this week. So phenomenal start from him. And then in terms of West Coast, I can't remember a team I've seen where teams just have that much time in their forward half, and just looking through the disposal efficiency for their players, it's just off the charts in terms of how bad it is. But as I say, it is such a competitive AFL at the moment. It is a difficult place for them to be. Well, interesting to see how they turn that around. Alan, would you sack the coach at the moment?
I mean, the time for that would have been probably end of last year if it was going to happen. Look, he has put his boot in and said that he's here for the long haul, and he's a really good coach. I mean, he's a premiership coach, so there is no denying his ability. But there is probably always going to be questions about whether he can stay here for the absolute long haul because it's going to be multiple years of being down the bottom of the ladder. I mean, I wouldn't for the time being. There's no need, but there's always going to be a lot of questions surrounding it and until. They actually have a bounce up the ladder, but you can't see that for a good couple of seasons.
I think at a club, sometimes you just need someone new in. But I think the other half of the equation, which maybe doesn't get touched on or considered, is who's out there. And I think there needs to be, you need to almost identify your next guy before you make that move. And for you, Alan, is there anyone out there who would do a better job at the moment? What do you think it would be if they were to move on? It would purely be just a youth approach and someone they see a spark in, as opposed to what's out there in the existing market?
Yeah, well, you're going to be choosing between sort of an experienced coach or an inexperienced coach. And coming into a team like that, you probably don't want somebody of inexperience. So in terms of the market, there's really only probably a handful, you're looking at probably a Buckley or a Leon Cameron, etc., that could take a job. But are they better coaches than Adam Simpson? You're probably not. So unless you're actually trying to look for the next best coach coming through, you're looking at maybe like you're looking at Australia, who's going to be the next young star coming through, like Damien Hardwick back when Richmond took over in 2009. That sort of player, that sort of coach. But then there is a bit of a guesswork, and they're going to be thrown right in the deep end.
If we move on to the next one involving your Tigers, Alan, this was a much more competitive game. I was lucky enough to be at this one. And even though Richmond are only 1-3, it feels like they've had a better season than that due to the negativity or sort of the acceptance, I suppose, that they might be a part of that bottom four just because there are so many teams who are strong and competitive above them. But a really good win for them against a team that's, arguably equal premiership favourites heading into this. So how did you find your Tigers in this one?
Yeah, this has probably been just great reward for the effort they've actually put in the last few weeks. You take away the first quarter against Gold Coast, they've been extremely competitive in all their games and right in it. Like they took Carlton right to the wire, arguably probably could have won it if they had a bit more composure. Port Adelaide, though, with a kick at three quarter time, and then it's just a bit of experience, etc., that Port Adelaide's able to take over. But against Sydney, it's just the full buy-in now of a club with youngsters. Like on the weekend, they had 10 players under 35 games. But they all have extreme pressure. So on the weekend, during the third quarter alone, had a pressure rating of 230 plus, which is enormous. And Sydney were just unable to move the ball at all from their back half. Blakey was making unforced errors, kicking straight to Richmond players, turnovers. They just couldn't get their game movement going. We can know when Sydney are on, their ball movement is electric, and there's not hardly a team had with the efficiency, the foot skills that can stop it. But they were just unable to use it because Richmond was taking away the short 45-meter kicks. They would have the Sydney to break open that middle of the ground. They were just trapped inside, and it's just the pressure of that forward half because they had Mansell had six tackles, and Morris Riley had six tackles. They had both had their best games of their career. Baker had another six tackles in that forward half, so it was just an immense amount of pressure, and it was like reminiscent of sort of when Richmond was sort of at their best a few years ago. But it's just good to see sort of young players take control of the game, and to see that the Richmond does have a lot of good youth. They just haven't had the experience coming through. They're not high-end draft picks, and as a result, they probably need a few extra years in the VFL to develop their skills. And they're starting to see a little bit of that talent start to show through. But when you still have the likes of Taranto, who was fantastic, his best game of the season, sort of back to his form last year, Baker, Bolton, Dan Rioli off the back line, you're still going to be extremely competitive, and with Richmond's not going to be a pushover. And you can then see Sydney definitely felt that on the weekend.
As a Tigers fan, are you pretty gutted if you don't make the top eight, or are you just happy with playing a positive style of football in relation to how you're expecting the end of the season?
I mean, I'm pretty realistic on our expectations this year. I mean, with the amount of injuries we have this right at the moment, it's more about just getting the games into the kids as much as possible, and showing a sort of game plan that's going to be, competitive and actually launch us into finals in the sort of future years. I mean, going into the sort of first half of the season, like first 6 weeks, you're probably not expecting that much because it's going to be instilling new game plans, going to be inconsistencies in quarters, and we have seen that so far where we've been dominant for periods, but then have lapses where we lose five, six goals. Even against Sydney, Sydney still kick six goals on us in a row, and that's still going to be a theme for Richmond games for the next few weeks at least. But as long as Richmond sort of gets above that sort of bottom four, which I think we really are not a bottom four team at our best, it's just the inconsistency. But also with the amount of injuries we have in terms of like forward line, back line, that it would put lots of pressure on a handful of players to pick up all the slack. And that's the biggest issue now with sort of Lynch going out for another half a season. Like, we don't really have that big focal point up forward that we can just rely on kicking on his head and get the crumbs.
I imagine you have to be pretty happy as a Tigers fan after such a good run, an extended three-peat, so to speak, and then your rebuild has started the way it has and looks like it's going to be as short as it is and seeing competitive footy even when you are meant to be down the bottom in your rebuilding period. So I'm sure the Tigers fans are loving that. For my game to recap, it is the Hawthorn game. So I'm a Hawthorn supporter. I was lucky enough to go to the MCG for the first time. It was just as incredible as you hear it is. If you haven't been there before, definitely get yourself down there to that. And I feel the midfield held its own in this one. I feel the issue for Hawthorn is those key positions, so not having a key defender for so long now, and even Mitch Lewis, Tom Stewart was able to just do a number on him. So I feel Trouble did play well, but just those really absolute key players you've got, Sicily and Frost are those sort of medium play a little bit above their size defenders, but just that intercept player that, the Cats had in Tom Stewart and Hawkins, who was really good in his 350th game as well, and of course Cameron. So in terms of that, as Sammy Mitchell said after the game, I think the midfield is about where it needs to be. Nash is looking more like his best, a little bit better from Newcombe, still a way to go from him, but Warble has just been absolutely phenomenal, probably almost best, three best on grounds for him so far, or certainly Hawthorn's best on ground so far. But Geelong look like they've really bounced back to potentially being a top four team again as well after their little hiccup, and it's just incredible the consistency that they've been able to generate. But I think Hawthorn are going to need a few more seasons to get those key position players in, really free Lewis up, and whether that's getting another key forward, whether Chole can do that down the line, because Lewis really hasn't started too well, and Chole, of course, having that workload going in as the backup ruckman for either Reeves or Meek, then it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But they just really need to get that key defender in. But the midfield, I think, would be a huge win for Mitchell, and he'd be happy with the situation there. So if we move on now to some tribunal news, and if we go to you, Alan, to talk about one of your Richmond boys in Baker getting the 1 week for his bump against Sydney.
Yeah, this was sort of reminiscent of last week with Wright. So Baker was caught sort of going against the flight to try and spoil the ball. And it was his, and he has all right to contest it, but he hits sort of Milliken sort of just on the chin in a way. So he's just late in terms of spoiling it, but he's not late in terms of, because Milliken's sort of there, ready to take a mark. He then drops it. Baker actually puts his fist in, which is something different to what Wright did the previous week. So Wright sort of jumps up, go for the mark, then pulls out the mark, so braces for contact, drops his shoulder in. Baker goes for the spoil, commits to the spoil, hits out. Milliken drops the ball, so his fist actually goes to where the ball was, but then because Milliken actually drops it because he's expecting the contact from Baker. The AFL then deemed that to be not a football action in terms of this occurring, and actually. But then suspends him because he makes slight contact with the head. Now, Milliken's absolutely fine, plays the entirety of the game. We have no issues of any sort of health or concussion outcomes. So it's sort of interesting to see how the Richmond obviously challenged the one match ban and it was unsuccessful in doing so. I definitely thought there was probably more cause for this to get off than the right one, and the 1 week probably didn't quite seem to match the outcome. It's definitely a free kick in the actual game, but in terms of a suspendable offence, I don't think it's there.
Yeah, so I think with that action too as well, Alan, is that it's sort of, we saw it right with Peter Wright, and that sort of split act second action there, where you're going to contest for the ball, and then all of a sudden the player comes in from the other side and is going for the same ball, and whether you pull out or not, and then get absolutely sort of, yeah, lectured to by the coach, it's sort of that instillment of fear in a way. And I think that's the worry if you're a player moving forward now for the rest of this season, is when it comes to a contest, say, on the wing, or say maybe on the half forward flank, and the ball's coming on one is being kicked to that side, and the players coming, two players are coming from different directions, and one manages to make contact, but then unfortunately cleans up the other player. Then unfortunately, that action pretty much is going to be sort of seen as, oh, he's not going for the ball. He's actually cleaned up his teammate, and now he's ended up in concussion and has to undergo the 12-day concussion protocols. That's sort of the fine line where it's very grey still, and that's the worry. But yeah, I think we've seen over the years with bumps, right, where players have managed to get off, right? Jared Waite's one's a perfect example from 2010 with his bump on Matthew Bates. He thought he would have got maybe 2 or 3 weeks for that hit, but he ends up not getting a suspension for it. So yeah, it's just when you look at the whole bump and how players are probably going to approach it now, you don't want them sort of backing away from it. No, that's not the problem. But what you want is sort of it to be within the vicinity enough that players are going to make a initial, well, first decision right away to go for the ball, and whatever happens, happens. So it's just one to sort of, yeah, keep a watch out for.
Yeah, so it's the one thing with Baker too. It's like he absolutely has every right to do what he did. And if Malkin probably didn't drop that mark, he would have spoiled it, and he'd probably be lauding about his courage and actually going back at the fight and actually, spoiling it. And that's the fine line. It's like 1 split second for a drop the mark there from Malkin, because he's actually putting the pressure on, and now he's resulted in actual suspension for himself. And that's the sort of grey area that the sort of AFL have at the moment with the rules change with Maynard last year. Because if this happened last year, he's absolutely not getting suspended at all. There's all agility because of the Maynard incident. So, I mean, they are obviously want to protect the head, and that's for a very good reason to do so. But I think for instances like that, you probably don't really want to see a suspension occurring.
No, definitely not.
Yuri, how do you feel about the Pendlebury open-handed slap punch on Neil in comparison with the ruling of just a fine for him?
Yeah, it's not great, look, Ben. But the thing is, though, when you look at players' tribunal records, it's something that you do have to take into account first. So Pendlebury is no recidivist whatsoever with the tribunal. How many times in Scott Pendlebury's career has he gone to the tribunal for a bump or breaking an opposition teammate, an opposition player's jaw? None. So it's pretty much a first offence. That's why 2 weeks ago, when George Hewitt, who's also never been in trouble with the tribunal, when he gut punched Lachie Neale, right, he copped what, a $2,500 fine. People were going on about, oh, he should have been suspended for 1 week, but then you got to take it into his tribunal record. It was clean. So the first strike, okay, great. Second strike, next time he does it, yeah, he'll cop a 1 week ban for it. But you can't go right away and say, oh, okay, you're suspended for one game because we haven't looked closely into your tribunal record. That's something that always probably has to be taken into account.
I think if we look back to Sicily, and I know there's been a lot of discussion around this, I didn't actually have too much of a problem with the kicking element. I had a problem, as you mentioned, Yuri, with his record. As a, he's the captain of the Hawthorn Footy Club. I have a problem with he's just, for want of a better word, a shit bloke. Like he just keeps doing these things over and over again. And that I think that's where I feel they almost didn't look into his record. And I think a lot of people were focused on the kick, but I think you just got to be looking at it from the AFL's perspective, and they're just looking at this guy going, you've done it again. You just keep doing this. You're not learning your lesson. I think that's where the issue is. But Alan, do you feel that Pendlebury used the open hand because he knew he wouldn't get a suspension as opposed to full on punching him?
No, I mean, I don't think there's any thought about suspensions comes into any player's minds when they could do an incident like that. And most of the time, it's just about sort of annoying frustration from being having some sort of close heat being put on them, things like that being niggly, etc. It's only something sort of instigating it. And definitely for Pendlebury, there's no way he's going to do something like that without some bit of provocation occurring prior to it. But I mean, for instance, like that, I don't see how it can be sort of suspended.
So if we move on to some chat about the other rounds, so I think everyone felt that the first edition of the Gather Round was a good success. We're going to get a good idea of how it goes in edition two of three. The AFL signed a 3-year deal to have Gather Round in Adelaide. How do you feel the future of Gather Round should go? Do you think they should keep it in Adelaide? They should move it? They should move away from it altogether? What do you think the future holds for Gather Round, and what would you do?
Well, what I'd like to see, Ben, is once this 3-year deal is up, is for it to move to various states, because that's where you can showcase the state as a whole. It's almost, for example, a tourism marketing campaign. That's how you can use it. Right when that first gather round last season, how many ads were there on South Australia? There were an absolute plethora of ads. Oh, visit South Australia for the week. You'll be absolutely treated to down in the Barossa Valley where you can enjoy our finest wines and all the best food we have and visit the Adelaide CBD precinct and everything. So that's pretty much the whole sort of, branding of the state, and which is a great thing too. And that's why I look into once this is all over in terms of this first contract, that you should take it to other states anyway. So WA's got a number of different venues that they can play. They can play at Geraldton, they can play at Esperance, they could play in Busselton, they could play in sort of Katanning or Meekatharra up north, because that's where a lot of those community football regions, right? And even the southern community regions, there's people love their football anyway. And it's such a small knit, tight knit community that people will absolutely flock to those games no matter what. And there you go. There's tourism right there for those particular places that, oh, there we go. There's a real influx of income coming through our way. We're sort of getting more of a exposure in terms of our sort of great place as well. And people all of a sudden sort of prick their ears and take more curiosity into that aspect. Same thing as well in Queensland, right? If you want to sort of branch out to Ipswich or say, I know Rockhampton, for example. There you go. There's a few venues right there you can play at. Maybe you can turn a rugby field into a footy field, for example. And there you can easily fit thousands of people into that one venue and basically showcase your brand there. Same thing in Victoria as well. You can play where? Ballarat, Bendigo, or all those various country areas in Victoria. There's another slab of big money for the state in itself too. Same in New South Wales, same in Tasmania if they want to as well. So that's my overall opinion on Gather Round, that it needs to be branched across, and South Australia has got its fair exposure as well, in a good way too, because that's what it deserves. That's why it needs to get onto the map for people to take notice of, and to really put down to other places as well, I think will be worthwhile, beneficial.
Yeah, I think from a business perspective, we're going to see states go to the AFL and ask for their own thing. Maybe it isn't Gather Round. I'm sure that they will ask for Gather Round, but I don't see South Australia, much like the talk around the MCG no longer hosting the grand final. Other venues want it, but Melbourne absolutely do not want to lose the grand final. I think it's the same with Gather Round. I wouldn't be surprised if perhaps, we see Tasmania in their first year or other states. I think opening round. Yeah, that was sort of the story around it when it first came around, that it was going to be, invading rugby league territory while they're away. And for whatever reason, that didn't end up happening. And that wasn't even how the alignment worked. But I think we're going to see states asking for their own sort of thing, whether it is Queensland, New South Wales getting opening round, whether it is some other sort of type of gather round or a heritage round or something like that, that's all in the one place. And I'm not sure from a commercial perspective if you can do multiple of them, but I think the states will definitely be asking for it. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's the direction we see it go. So if we move on now to our previews, we've got Wayne Miller having his patellar surgery, so he's out for Adelaide versus Melbourne, the opening round of Gather Round at the Adelaide Oval. And then we've got Murphy also out with his MCL. So Yuri, do you want to talk us through what you see as the big changes for this one and how you see it paying out?
Yeah, so Adelaide have made five changes to their team as well from last week's disappointing 35-point loss to Fremantle, Ben. And one of the other omissions was James Borlase, but they get Jordan Butts back into the side as well, Adelaide's key defender. So that's going to be at least a big in as well for the Crows to somehow curtail Melbourne's very sort of, you can almost say pacey forward line, but very sort of, very just sort of high IQ forward line as well. They always pick the right spots at the right time too. And with Bailey Fritsch's leading patterns up forward and Ben Brown and Cozzy Pickett at ground level there too. So it's going to be an extremely tough challenge for Adelaide, but where it all comes down to is contested ball for Adelaide and how far can they stack up against Melbourne with the likes of Christian Petrarca, Clayton Oliver, Jack Varney, Tom Sparrow. And I always believe Sparrow doesn't really get the plaudits that he does deserve because he goes so much under the radar. So that's one to really keep an eye out too for Adelaide. And if that whole Gawn to Petrarca combination bursting out from the midfield happens once more, as it did against Hawthorn 2 weeks ago, then you can almost kiss the game goodbye, and it's going to be quite a long way back for the Crows. And if Rankin and Richelli are able to really bob up early on and get their tails up and hit those ground levels at full speed and really just impact the scoreboard in a way too, that's going to keep Adelaide right in the contest. So look out for those couple of areas too. But the whole worry is then for Adelaide is going up forward and trying to somehow get through that two-line brick wall of Stephen Mayne and Jack Lever, because you can't afford to be bombing the ball in their direction where either one of them can easily go up third man, kill a contest over the boundary line for a throw-in, or just roam free and take an intercept mark. Yeah, Adelaide, you got to somehow lower your eyes as they haven't done for the first three rounds this season, and just be as meticulous as possible, but also try and play with a helter-skelter approach, because that's the way that we've seen from the Crows this last season. Where they've generated success, it's been through fast ball movement, and that's what they need at all costs against Melbourne, because you go slow against them, it allows Melbourne to set up their back line with such ease and just really falls bait into their own hands. I see the Crows somehow addressing those issues, but how far they're able to do it for the full 120 minutes, well, we don't really know too much more about that too, but I see Melbourne winning this game by about 17 points for my Bam.
Yeah, awesome. So if we head across now to one of the more interesting clashes with the Gold Coast, they've looked really good. The Dogs, there's some questions about whether the Dogs are actually back, or a difficult trip to Ballarat where they play so well as well, or the Giants, and they just on top of the ladder, of course, at the moment. So whether they can continue their strong form, both of them away from home, of course, is at Adelaide Hills on Sunday at 12:30 when we turn the clocks back and daylight saving time is over. Alan, do you think the Gold Coast can continue their hot form here?
Yeah, I have a feeling that GWS would be a bit far too strong here, but I think for the Gold Coast, it's more about exposure for the young kids and trying to get their game plan sorted. Look, they had a couple of early wins to start with, looking great. The midfield's starting to really purr through with Rail, etc., getting really all their clearances, etc., so getting the ball movement going really well. But in terms of, on the flip side of this week, though, but they do have a couple of confirmed debutants this week. We're looking at Sam Clohisi, Ethan Reid, and Will Graham. So Ethan Reeves, they're pick 9, and Will Graham was pick 26. So a couple of academy kids starting to come through. Had Jed Waddle last week, so they're really starting to blood that next another wave almost of young talent coming through that Gold Coast region. So there's a lot of potential there. But GWS, so like they've only played a couple of three games so far, and they looked really untouchable so far with how much ball movement etc. they're going through the half back line with Whitfield just electric at the moment. You'll be expecting that to be far too strong. I think. The Gold Coast to really have any chance of here, they've got to really win that midfield battle and take it up to the likes of Tom Green and Kelly. But I think they'll probably find it a bit too hard to control that forward line, though. I mean, they do have Ballard back there, which I think is a really underrated defender. And Sam Collins as well, he probably doesn't get the plaudits he probably deserves. So that sort of back two are really great for Gold Coast, but they've just got too many avenues now that GWS have that they won't be able to sort of curtail. I mean, I think the Gold Coast will give a good accounting for themselves, but I can't see them sort of getting within probably four goals of GWS in the end.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see over there. We move on to what's my game of the round. I assume it might be yours as well. Yuri Fremantle versus Carlton. Are you able to attend this one, and how do you see it playing out in general?
No, unfortunately not be able to attend the game, Ben, but yeah, I think it's going to be a good test for us as well with Fremantle's lively, pacey small forwards at ground level too. Sam Switkowski, Michael Frederick, Tom Emmett, who's fitted in seamlessly. And not many people outside WA circles would know who Tom Emmett is, but he was outstanding for Peel Thunder last year in the Waffle and was one of Peel's best players in that grand final loss to East Fremantle. He's been a really nice addition as well, filling in for Lachie Schultz, well, with Schultz's departure to Collingwood, of course. And Michael Walters there, who we've already mentioned, was by far the most dangerous forward against the Crows last Friday night with his 2 goals for. That's the area I have concerns as a Carlton supporter in that aspect too, is the ball hits a ground level, then their speed may get us too. Even though we have Adam Saad there, we have Jordan Boyd, who both players, especially Saad, is extremely quick. We have Nick Newman there down back. So we've got the medium defenders to cover for that anyway, if it does sort of get to that point too. But also Jacob Wiedering's return last Friday against North Melbourne from that, well, you can almost say severe calf strain, which he suffered during the preseason. Just his marshalling the troops down back as well was just, yeah, first class as he's done for a long time in his career. And the midfield just, yeah, rang rings, right, with Adam Scherrer, George Hewitt, Patrick Cripps had another great game. So did Blake Akers. And up forward, of course, Harry Mackay and Charlie Curnow combined for 9 goals between them. And it's going to be a good test, I think, for Fremantle as well, with Alex Pearce and Luke Ryan. Both defenders have had outstanding starts to the season, especially Pearce as well, with his performance on Taylor Walker last week, holding him goalless. But Luke Ryan's intercept marking and his drive as well, that's a big thing, I think, that probably goes a little bit under the radar with Ryan, is his ability to rebound and his kicking penetration from the back half, which really gives Fremantle this sort of template to set up their attacks from their back 50, and that's why he's really important in that aspect too. But I think those bigger Carlton bodies as well is going to prove a big challenge for Fremantle's ever-improving midfield. They have Caleb Sarong, Andy Brayshaw, Matthew Johnson's had a good start to the season. So, yeah, just in that regard for Fremantle, they'll be in the contest. That's the one thing I'll say about it one bit too, is they'll really give a good account of themselves. But when you look at probably the cream to the crop as well, I think that's where Carlton's experience and class should get the job done. I think by about, I'm going to say roughly around 3 goals.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you on that one, Yuri. If we go to our final in-depth preview, it's your boys, the Tigers, up against St Kilda at Norwood Oval, second last game of the round on a Sunday. Do you think you can get the win against the Saints? They've been an interesting start to the season, tough loss. Do you think Ross will have them up and about, or do you think the Tigers will come through in this one, Alan?
Yeah, this is a really interesting game for St Kilda because, I mean, the first game against Geelong, they probably could have won that, but didn't. And then had a very good win against Collingwood. And then against Essendon, they probably let it go. They had what they were leading for the impression the entirety of the game until it's a string of goal. And that last quarter got them ahead. But I think they just last week, I guess, and they just missed Max King. Now they get Max King back this week. And that just shores up their forward line. They have that connection throughout. They have that big focal point. And they sort of missed that. And they sort of just let. So Essendon have uncontested marks in that back half. I mean, they let Essendon look back three in Martin, Heppel, and McGrath have like 30% of the entire possessions to Essendon. Like it was ridiculous. They just letting them kick mark the slow ball move at their back half. They didn't press up on them at all. And that sort of thing is probably not reminiscent. I think that would be very much highlighted by Ross Lyon this week, and they come out extremely hard and with a lot of ferocity. So it's going to be an extremely high pressure game, especially if Richmond can maintain that pressure they did against Sydney. So it's going to be a very contested, very scrappy game. You won't see a lot of great ball skills throughout. I do expect St Kilda to still get the win here. They're definitely a far more advanced side than Richmond are at the moment. And with Lynch and now Bolter both being injured for the next few weeks, their forward line's not going to, it's going to struggle quite a lot. So I don't see Richmond be able to kick a sort of winning score against St Kilda. So I think probably St Kilda probably get it done by a couple of goals, but it will be a very tight contest though.
So we just go through the remainder of the games and fill out with our tips if you are following along with that. So I've got Adelaide versus Melbourne to open up. We've got your tip in, Yuri. In this one, I think Adelaide might keep it close. They might be up and about with that home gather-round advantage, so to speak. I think Melbourne are just too good, though. So I think Melbourne by around 10 to 12 points. Alan, how do you see it?
Yeah, I think Melbourne have been far too good. At the moment, Adelaide just, their ball movement and connection inside 50 is not there. And I think Melbourne will just eat them up, really. So I'll probably got them by about 4 goals.
Next, I've got Brisbane Lions versus North Melbourne at Norwood on Friday afternoon. Yuri, who's you got in this?
So I've got the Lions winning by about 6 goals, Ben, but I think North Melbourne will be extremely competitive for 2.5 quarters for mine. I think the whole dash and depth, they're able to really exploit that. And really what Brisbane, we've already spoken about, right, have been sort of lacking accountability defensively, then I think North Melbourne can get them for that period of time. But then just Brisbane's whole season class, I think, should just get them over the line and be able to sort of power away in the end.
Yeah, and for me, I think this is the game that Brisbane need, like an easy beat to start, get their game sort of going. Like a lot of things have been going right for them, contested possessions, clearances, that aspect of the game is still there, but it's their connections on 450 has sort of been lacking at the moment, and that's maybe against a team who has no defence really in North Melbourne, it could be the sort of fire starter for their season. So I think it'll be them by about probably 5, 6 goals.
I think Brisbane will get off to a hot start and then North will slowly claw their way back through the rest of the game. We've seen Brisbane do that where they just start like a house on fire and then they have that terrible habit even last year when they were so good, didn't lose at the Gabba. They still had that habit throughout the season of getting clawed back. I think they will ultimately win by 4 or 5 goals, but I think North will get it close, you know, around three-quarter time and there will be a few nerves amongst the Lions fans there. Next, we move on to the other home team, so to speak, of Gather Round, Port Adelaide versus Essendon at the Adelaide Oval a bit later on a Friday night. I think Port Adelaide are the real deal. I think they are quite good again this season because they did lose at home to Melbourne by 7, but I just think Melbourne are probably maybe the third best team in the comp at the moment. So I don't think there's any shame in that loss, and they are going. Essendon, it was a bit of a strange game against St Kilda. I think they have looked maybe a little bit better than some people have seen them. But then, you know, in terms of their own expectations, they've maybe been, you know, a little bit lower as well. So I think Port Adelaide just too strong, maybe by 25 or around 4 goals in this one. Yuri, how do you see it?
Yeah, I think the power is running as well across the ground is going to be a real difference in the game. I think Essendon got a lot better at that too, Ben. But I think accountability-wise, defensively, just like Brisbane, they can often go missing. At times they can switch off for five, six minute period, should I say, and it really cost them the game. So I end up seeing Port winning by probably 3 or 4 goals for mine.
Yeah, for me, I think Port actually had a pretty good game against Melbourne. I mean, they did lose, but they had the majority of the field game. They had the majority of the clearances. So all the statistics pointed to them winning and probably quite comfortably. It was just the fact that they pressed up so hard, which is a very aggressive Ken Hinckley game style. And that will probably think be too much for Essendon because Essendon don't have probably the skill and execution that probably Melbourne does with the greater level of depth in their team. So I could expect to probably see, especially on their home deck, Port Adelaide being quite comfortable winners here, probably by about 5 goal margin.
And next up, the Adelaide Hills on midday. We'll be out for lunch on Saturday. We've got the 2005 and 2006 rivalry between West Coast and Sydney. Not that much of a rivalry these days, but Alan, how do you think that Sydney and West Coast will go? Do you think there's any chance that West Coast get their first win here, or is Sydney going to have a bit of a bee in their bonnet after losing to Richmond?
Well, if you go back to last year, Sydney scored 200 points against them. And the better form that Sydney are in, especially coming off a hard loss this week, I expect them to bounce back quite much. So I think it'll be a very hard game for West Coast. And if they get within 60 points, I think they're doing a pretty good job here. So I think Sydney quite comfortably.
Yeah, I have to agree too, Alan. Sydney's whole ball movement, once they get that slingshot off half back and throw it in the middle of the ground, they're impossible to stop. And West Coast, I think, will be competitive at least for another, probably for first quarter once again. But after that, it's just somehow if they can maintain that pressure, because if they can't, then they'll just completely be sliced to ribbons. I expect Sydney to win this by probably 13 to 14 goals for mine.
Yeah, it's just so hard to have hope around West Coast. I can only imagine if you're a supporter of them. And I think Sydney's ball movement and use of the footy is just too good, a little bit off against the Tigers. But, no home ground advantage for West Coast here either. So, yeah, I could easily see 80 to 100 point win for Sydney and racking up the scores there again. But hopefully for West Coast fans and for just the state of the competition in general, we don't see that. Yuri, you've covered us through probably the game of the round for mine, Fremantle versus Carlton at the Adelaide Oval at 4:20 on Saturday. I think Carlton might be a bit too strong. I actually think they might pull away a little bit here, maybe by 30 or around 5 to 6 goals. I think that Freo maybe have been overperforming a little bit, but it is definitely good to see that they've outperformed perhaps what their fans were expecting after last season and that sort of lower mid-table finish. So, Alan, how do you see this one playing out?
Yeah, I sort of reiterate your point there, Ben. I think they are probably Freo probably outperforming a little bit more to expectation, I probably thought. But this is a really good litmus test against a quality side, which we think are probably going to be a top four at the end of the year and a premiership contender in Carlton. So I think their midfield has been really good so far, and so we'll get to see how they stack up against a proper outfit in Cripps and Hewitt, who actually pride themselves on being extremely contested. And last year, they were by far the best inside mid team in the competition. So we get to see how Freo will stack up there. But I always think that the strength across the board and the fact that Carlton now have, I think, different elements of the game in terms of scoring from the back half and also their clearance dominance too, which I think is far too strong for Freo. So I'll probably expect probably Carlton by probably 3 goals.
We move on to the Adelaide Oval again late on Saturday night. We've got the Western Bulldogs versus Geelong. I think this is a really tough one to call as well. Both teams in really good form. Dogs 2 wins in a row. Geelong have won all of their three. I think it's a real contrast in terms of you've got the star-studded Dogs midfield and not too much on the key positions up forward and down back. But then Geelong, you've got Tom Stewart and Hawkins just absolutely dominating on with those vintage players on either end there. Yuri, how do you see this one?
So I've actually got the Western Bulldogs winning this game by a couple of goals, Ben. I just don't know why. It just feels though the confidence within the last couple of weeks has come back within the group. They feel a little bit more rejuvenated as well. They didn't have to rely so much on Bontempelli last week. And we saw Adam Treloar, of course, he's always super consistent, have another really good game. And yes, of course, down back, they can be vulnerable at the best of times. That is a worry. But if they're able to somehow repel both Cameron and Tom Hawkins from having their big games, then they're going to be every chance of winning the contest. But then the equation is, how do they quell Tom Stewart? So that's going to be a big part to watch out for. But yeah, I definitely have the Dogs winning this one though.
Yeah, so this is by far, I think, the hardest game to tip of this round. I think the Adelaide Oval will be sort of suit Geelong with how they press up so high, that narrow ground. I mean, they did it very well against Adelaide a couple of weeks ago. He's also St Kilda on the home ground. They really struggled in sort of getting the ball past because of that high press. And I think that might, again, be too much for the Dogs, but it will depend so much on that midfield. If the Dogs are able to dominate that midfield against the young Cats lineup, they will get that initial territory, which will then help their game sort of set up, and they'll get the repeat inside 50s, and they'll get the scoring of that generation. So it kept happening. But I mean, if the Geelong, though, are able to match that midfield, I think their defensive network and this coach, Chris Scott, will be a bit too much for then the Dogs to get through, and they'll allow Geelong to stay in the game. But, I mean, it's going to be extremely close, so I've probably got Geelong by about 2 points.
Yeah, I genuinely can't split these two. I'm going to go for a draw, a bit of a cop out, but you got to have a draw once a season, so I'll make my one here. Alan, you've talked about the Gold Coast versus GWS. Yuri, do you think the Giants march on from here?
Yeah, I think so too, Ben. And just the whole, yeah, that running in waves that everyone knows about, right? I think it's just going to ultimately prove too much for the Suns and the whole precision ball move in terms of their efficiency, especially by foot. That's the one that's absolutely going to kill the Suns if they turn a ball over in their back half and straight into the waiting arms of maybe a Josh Kelly or Lachie Whitfield there, because it'll just completely bisect the forward half and find a target. So if you're the Suns, though, they're going to really match, I think, toe for toe as well. With their speed across the ground, I think that's not going to be the issue. But then again, it's sort of, yeah, that sustainability, especially clearances and tackling pressure as well, because the Giants definitely got that back against West Coast. So, yeah, I've got the Giants winning this by about 3 to 4 goals.
Yeah, three new young players in for the Suns in this one as well. And I think they have shown some signs of improvement under Hardwick, even though if you look back, a six-point win over the Crows, who have gone on to not be too good, losing to the Dogs. I see GWS by maybe 30 in this one, but hopefully some promising signs continue there for the Suns. Alan, again, you've taken us through your boys against St Kilda, Richmond versus St Kilda at Norwood Oval on Sunday at 3:20. Have you got the Saints in this one, Yuri, or how do you see it?
Yeah, I've got the Saints winning this by probably 2 or 3 goals. It really is hard to depend whether it's going to be low scoring or sort of high octane, because we've seen the Saints this season alone, and it's been pretty unusual for a St Kilda team to really have a lot of sort of speed through the ball, should I say, and also just try and play on at all costs. But yeah, I see the Saints prevailing in this one though.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree by around 3 or 4 goals in that. And then finally, to round out Gather Round, we've got Collingwood versus Hawthorn at the Adelaide Oval on Sunday. I see Hawthorn being able to get a bit closer in this one. I know we beat them last season, and I just feel that under Sam Mitchell, we do just are so hot and cold in terms of there are games when we can really just match it in the midfield and take it to teams, and then there's others where we completely fall off. We had 2 quarters against Geelong where we pretty much fell off. So I can see a game where against Collingwood that isn't what they were last year, even though they did bounce back a bit last week, that we keep it a bit closer, still lose by maybe 2 to 3 goals though. But Alan, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Hawks are probably going to start slowly getting into the season and be far more competitive. But this one, I still think Collingwood probably, again, Collingwood are going to be far too strong. But their game's still not humming, even though they got the win against Brisbane. They're still down in clearances. They're still down in territory. They're still down in inside 50s. So they're all the elements that are not quite still clicking, even though they got the win on the board and a really good game, really good away win at Brisbane. But there's still going to be a lot of concerns there for McRae. But I think they'll probably start to, iron them out against Hawthorn. But I mean, I still expect them probably to win by probably 4 goals. But it's going to be definitely a bit more competitive, as you say. I think Hawks will be definitely out of the match in the midfield.
Think pressure-wise too is going to be a big one as well for Hawthorn, is how much they were able to maintain it against Collingwood, because those were probably the first signs last week that the Magpies are slowly getting back to their best. It's only one game and that's a very minuscule sample size, but it just sort of typifies what Collingwood's all about. And whereas with Hawthorn's midfield as well, it's a great test for their young midfield there with Cam McKenzie, should I say, and Jai Newcombe there, how much they can really sort of take it up their own against Collingwood's very classy midfield in there too. And also the Finn McGuinness matchup on Nick Dacos. We saw last season, right? Dacos was held to just 5 touches before he, I think, suffered a hairline fracture to his knee, and which ruled him out for the next 6 weeks of footy. So that's one to really keep an eye on too, and how much of a sort of a tag does McGuinness play on Dacos right throughout that contest. But yeah, I think for Hawthorn too, the small forward brigade, no Nick Watson for the next 6 weeks as well, that saw so a sprained rolled ankle, which he sustained in the last 23 seconds against Geelong, and how Jack Ginnivan fares up against his former side and Dylan Moore down there too. Just how much sort of forward punch can the Hawks generate? That's going to be the real point here, I think, as well for Hawthorn against Collingwood's backline. And it's almost the same thing for Adelaide as well. Like with the Adelaide Melbourne game, is Hawthorn's entries inside 50 after the first quarter, which was absolutely deplorable. The rest of the game for probably the quarters 2 and 3 was pretty solid. And I think if they can use our sort of a example to use against Collingwood, and we've seen the Magpies be vulnerable. So those are pretty much just the pointers, I think, for Hawthorn to really go by and give themselves every shot. And they only have to look to last year to see what they did against the Magpies. But I just see Collingwood taking this one home by probably 3 to 4 goals.
Yeah, fantastic. Gather around the footy to look forward to. Thank you so much, Yuri and Alan, for your time with us this evening. Enjoy your footy this weekend.
Cheers, Ben.
Cheers, Ben.
To everyone listening, thank you very much for your time with us this evening. Make sure you follow us on Spotify and subscribe to our podcast in your feed. We've got a lot of other offerings at the network at the moment as well. You can see Yuri over on our NBA show. Alex does a fantastic job over there. For those boys who are talking about the NBA, we have a lot of our footy fans we know who love the basketball as well. Hopefully you're following us on socials on our Instagram at the moment. You can go and do your own votes. We'll be keeping a leaderboard on the Mojo Medal, which is our equivalent of the Brownlow Medal as well. So make sure you're following us on socials and you don't miss out, and have a great gather round, especially if you're going to the games.